Poetry in Iowa today on Scribble.
Welcome to Scribble, 30 minutes of conversation, comments, and reviews on reading and writing, editing, publishing, and selling books. I'm Roald Tweet.
And I'm Don Wooten. We'll talk about the Iowa Poetry Association today with its Vice President, Max Mulliston, on Scribble. Almost rechristened you there, Max.
Hey. Still sitting here. Well,
it's been a while. How have you been?
I'm in good shape.
Okay.
82 and in good shape.
Well, that's fine. And you're still messing around with the Iowa Poetry Association.
I'm very much a part of it.
Tell us about that. What is it? What does it seek to do?
And well, the Iowa Poetry Association is an old adventure in literature in Iowa. I can't tell you exactly how many years, but it's probably 70, something of that nature. And we have the Lyrical Iowa, which I did not bring. The Lyrical Iowa is a publication each mm-hmm. year of submitted poetry and winners and placers throughout the state of Iowa. You have to be in Iowa.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a thick volume. It's probably half an inch or maybe a little more than that. So that's a big adventure, and we publish that and sell it for $10.
Uh-huh.
And we still have a few left, but I did not bring my copies for you today, and I'm sorry about that. Mm-hmm. But we just encourage poetry, and sometimes forcefully and sometimes gently, that poetry is not an easy thing to do, but if you have the bent for it, if you kind of feel like your words are working together and working for you and working for the listener's ear, go ahead and do it. You know, you can do two stanzas, you can do five stanzas or whatever you want to. When I began all this writing of poetry and so forth back in the early 80s, I would do two stanzas maybe or six lines or something of that nature. And I still like that format, but I can stretch it out to 80 lines or whatever you need. I happen to be the first vice president, and that and a cup of coffee is about where you are, you know.
So do you have regular meetings?
We're all volunteers.
Do you have regular meetings?
Yes, we do. We have a lot of times we have monthly meetings leading into some event, but we have events two times a year that are critiques, and we offer anyone in the membership or anyone else to submit a poem. I think the lunch and the meeting are $10, and the lunch is what's worth it. You know, the lunch is worth it. And so we have those twice a year, and we have great critiques from the universities around the Central Iowa, I suppose, Ames and Des Moines mm-hmm. and so forth. And so it's a learning situation for the people that submitted their poems, because the critiquers work with the poems, write down whatever they think about the poem, what they would change and so forth, and it comes back to the poet. We usually have 40 poems and in attendance. It's a Methodist church on the east side of Des Moines, and that's where it's always been held that I know of. And I've seen over the – and I'm, of course, a reader. Mm-hmm. I'm one of the people that reads the poems. And we have another person that reads. I'm a guy, and there's a gal that reads the poems and presents them, let's put it that way. We are the presenters. And I think people get a good deal of information from it. But not everybody comes there with their leaning forward and so forth. They just want to kind of be in a social group and hear some poetry and hear theirs, as a matter of fact. They want to hear theirs read. Mm-hmm. But I'm very happy with it. I may be easy to please, but I'm very happy with it.
Well, you know, you have an ally in Tweet because he's always pushing people to write poetry. Well, actually, to write anything. He wants you to write on bathroom walls if necessary, but just write.
Well, yeah, one of the questions that Wood and I fight about are, do you, you know, Coleridge said, poets are born, not made. That is, you can't turn yourself into a poet. But Emerson, whom I agree with, said, you know, the people all fancy they hate poetry, yet they're all poets and mystics.
Yes. And
do you think everybody is deep down a poet? Are kids poets?
You know, that's hard to say. But if you're adventurous and if you've got a command of the language and you've got some – you feel good about yourself and you observe. I do a lot of poetry observing things because I was a reporter, of course, and the reporters have to observe, you know, to figure out what they want to do. But other than that, I have found that the quality of the poetry in Iowa, submitted by whomever submits it, is improved very much in the last 10, 15, 20 years.
Why would that be?
I think that this sounds a little crude, but I think all the grandma poems are gone. Grandma, you know, writing about grandma or grandma writing about the grandsons and so forth. And we have a lot of things that concern us in the daily life and in political life and in group life and so forth. And sometimes that's the pulse that makes the poem. If you like it, you can write about it. If you don't like it, you can complain in a poem. That's perfectly legitimate.
But, you know, it often happens in anyone's life that trying to express themselves on something, that what comes out of them is not normal speech. It is suddenly elevated. And it doesn't have to be in perfect grammar. It just suddenly expresses something so beautifully, completely, succinctly even, that is poetry. Now, they may not be able to build on it, but I think poetry lurks around the corner for everyone who talks to other people or about other people.
I do too. I think it's a – I have with me – I won't read it today, but I've even gone into reading like Field and Streams, and if I'm in a hospital waiting room, Field and Stream, and picking out a phrase that's not too long, not too short, that a writer did, and working that into a poetry structure, you know, stanzas or so many lines and so forth. And he's retired now, but a great outdoor writer in the Gazette, Cedar Rapids paper. And I've taken two or three of his articles and just made a poem out of a portion of what he did.
Mm-hmm. So what makes something a poem? How do you, you know, today we don't have to rhyme, we don't have to have meter. How do you know when something's a poem?
I don't think you do. I think you declare it a poem. This is my poem.
To say it is.
Yeah. Yes, that's correct. I mean, I like structure, and I use structure, but there are a lot of poets today that don't use any structure. They do it on their own, and they get published to Poetry Magazine or some of the other places that they can get published. It depends on if someone that's editing that particular segment of the magazine or whatever likes it. You know?
Yeah, if it resonates, and the only test really is time. If something is really solid and it doesn't just quickly disappear, it'll be registered officially as poetry, and it'll survive.
Well, some of it survives, some of it doesn't. I like to go back to I use this quite often. This is 100 famous poems, and the publication date is 1918, so it's a 100-year-old poem book, and I find some things in there to write about or to think about that gives me ideas to write down some poetry. Mm-hmm. So I've probably got 400 books of poetry on poetry and all that kind of stuff at home. So if I run into a problem with 50-plus lifestyles the particular month that I'm looking for, I just get out two or three of those books and run through them and see what's appropriate or see what's suitable for me.
I get the idea from reading your column in 50-plus lifestyles and just what you've been saying now that that for you, quite often, a poem, your poem, is triggered by a phrase from another piece of writing.
Sure, sure. There has to be inspiration somewhere. And you can't, a lot of times, we as poets can't provide our own inspiration. It has to come from somewhere.
You know? It could come from nature, right?
Oh, very much so. Very much so.
I know, but you do talk a lot in your 50s-plus lifestyle about being reminded by, the last one was on Ted Kooser.
Yeah.
And how Ted Kooser gets you going and stuff like that, and just what you've said now. So it's interesting. That's true with Dick Stahl, too, incidentally, that almost always a little epigraph by someone will trigger the poem in him, which might be a
completely different kind of thing. He's a wonderful friend and a great poet, I think. Mm-hmm.
Read us something of yours.
Well, okay. I'm going to read, I will read one that I've written recently. It's called Upsmanship. I have to take my glasses off to read. Now, there's no explaining for that. No explaining for that.
I know the feeling.
Yeah. Upsmanship. The UP is capitalized in the title. On highest limb, one bird clings to observe, awaiting commotion to fly. My weakened eye sees a cardinal on this perch. I'm told it's a blue jay. We use new ideas and formulas to get things off the ground, rejoicing as they rise. Birds release from a branch or launch from earth, leaving mathematics behind, as they always have.
Very good.
That would it's just a watching the out of a window near my chair. Mm-hmm. Now, with the leaves in, you can't see the birds as well. But in the wintertime and so forth, you can see those birds flitting around. But I have written quite a few poems about birds, and they're, of course, they're the champions of the earth because they can fly.
Oh, yeah.
By themselves. But science has made birds a lot smarter over the years. The scientists are writing papers on birds and discovering things about birds that the birds don't even know. They just go ahead and do it. Yeah.
Do you have a regular schedule for writing, or does you just happen to be sitting in the hospital waiting room reading Field and Stream and all of a sudden a phrase
That's not a bad idea.
Trigger a poem.
I don't have – no. Kooser used to say he got up at 4:30 in the morning, did his poetry for a while, and then got dressed and went to his job. And that's not necessarily how I do it. Of course, I'm retired, whatever inspires me, something. And I'm a creative guy. I'm sitting here with two other creative people, today.
Where are they? I don't see them.
Well, they speak sometimes on the radio. But anyhow, the creative aspect is to me, is the thing that powers poetry, powers literature in general, but it powers poetry. If you're creative enough, and you can transfer feelings that you have and things that you see into some lines on a piece of paper, whether you write them or manufacture them some other way, that's creative. And I'm very much for that, and I stress that. But I have seen, in my time, I have seen 35 years of writing poetry, I've seen great improvement with the people that I knew. How proud I am of that. Mm-hmm. And occasionally they say, well, you were my mentor. And I say, well, I just helped you once or twice, But I'm just proud of the way that Quad Cities in particular has a lot of poets. May I read a
sure.
poem by a friend of mine?
Yeah.
Let me see if I got it here. Isn't that always the way we are? With a lot of paper on our desks. This is by Mike Bales. Some of you may know Mike and have heard his...
We've had him on this program.
Yeah. And I just think this is an outstanding poem, but you'll have to judge yourself. It's called Meadowlark. You are the laborer laboring. You are the aching back, the body of sweat cursing your labor. I am the meadowlark in flight, bright river of memories, drawn and flowing through me. I'm the keeper of the sun. You're the paycheck seeking more. You're the ledger on someone's account, ever filed, ever called to do even more. I am the sun and stars at night, the ever-present song in flight. I just think that's a wonderful poem.
It is.
There's two or three poems, and as I said, I've followed Mike's work for a number of years, literature and poetry, and I think that he's done just what other people involved in creativity and literature need to do, and that it's improve year after year. Don't drop out. Don't drop out just because your mom says that's not anything to be proud of. You know, mm-hmm. Just go ahead and. As a matter of fact, when I started writing poetry, nobody knew it. I sat downstairs in our home and wrote my poems, and everybody else was upstairs watching the tube or something like that. So I had a head start and a hidden, kind of a hidden agenda. But it's done me well over the years. You know, I just enjoy it so much.
Well, you've been a reporter. You've been on this medium for a long time, and I think just the business of using words, if so many people don't have the occasion to express in language what they see and what they feel, there's no obligation to do that, so you just take it in. But once you get into the practice of saying and writing, all of a sudden the stuff that's in your head goes into another medium.
I use this example. For the last 27 years that I broadcast here in the Quad Cities, I was a farm broadcaster. And I had, occasionally I'd have a minute and a half, but not always. I'd have the cartridge that we used to record. We used to use the cartridges to record, 70 seconds, maybe 71, and the smaller ones were 40 seconds. Well, I had to do a lot of programs in 70 seconds and a lot of them in 40 seconds. So I had to choose my words carefully. Maybe working instead of saying agriculture, I said farmer. You know, mm-hmm. Fewer syllables fit them in. So it's a learning process. I think it's a wonderful process. You just experiment with. You're experimenting with yourself. You're experimenting with your own ideas. You're experimenting with the words that you see, with the people that talk to you, with events that take place, and. And for a lot of us creative people, all of that stuff goes somewhere in our body and sticks around for a while, you know. mm-hmm. I have recently done my last work, I think, on a long poem that I did for the Streeter family in New Windsor, Illinois. I started it in 1993.
That's
I think it's Larry Streeter. I'm not positive that's his first name, but we were on a committee in Rock Island County, some farm type thing, and he said, "Well, I'll give you some letters that my people wrote from Canada. They went to Canada, you know, and homesteaded." And he said, "I'd like to have a book out of it." And I said, "I can't write you a book. I can do a poem for you." So I have labored over the years, three-line stanzas. I just worked it all over the place, and I think I'm done with that, and I'm going to ship it out there now, finally.
Your average poem doesn't take that long. I was going to ask you about revision, where revision fits into you.
Oh, I love to revise it. I love to. You know, there are a lot of poets, and you know a lot of them, who write this poem down, and that's it. That's mm-hmm. it. But that comes from broadcast writing, mm-hmm. you know. The first time you write something for a broadcast, it's not bad. Second time, it's a heck of a lot better, you know, the revisions we use, the rewrites we use. But I have, since I'm using a personal computer now for almost all of my writing, I can sit down there at times and I can waste a little time, valuable time, of course, with poetry. I can look at that poem and I say, you know, there's some changes I could make in this. I could cut out a few words. Maybe I can cut out a whole line. And it compacts it, maybe makes the subject build a little bit better, and it sounds better. You know, since we're broadcasters here, I am I'm a spoken word guy. You know, I can go to McDonald's and go inside and speak to them, say, "I'll take this," you know, instead of sitting in the car outside. But I've always been a a talker and a language guy, and that's who I am today.
Well,
I'm talking to the radio, and we're talking about language.
I've always said I never know what I think until I hear what I say.
Right. Well, the reason I asked about revision is I just read an essay by Mary Oliver in which she says that after about 40 or 50 revisions, it begins to sound pretty good.
Mary Oliver is a great, great poet. Kuzer, you know, would revise a poem and take it to his secretary, his own secretary in the insurance office, and have her read it. And if she didn't like it, he'd go home and change some things in it. That's, mm-hmm. Yeah, he's a great Midwest poet. He's the grassroots of who we are, and with a little spice in there. Wonderful words, wonderful situations that are normally commonplace. I can still remember the one where the mice were going along the fence with parasols or something. I can't remember the poem, but
Well, Max, you've been at it a while, and you don't quit. And we appreciate that, your work in the Poetry Society and also on your own. It's good to hear your voice again on radio.
Thank you very much, Don.
And thanks for visiting us today. Max Mollison, who is the vice president of the Iowa Poetry Society. Is that, get that name right?
Iowa Poetry Association.
Association.
Well, but I think it's a society anyhow, but they just have to name it something.
Right. It's a nice group of people.
Yeah, it is. It really is.
Anyway, thanks again, Max. I got it right now. Well, Max is energetically an advocate for poetry, even as you are, Tweet.
Yes, well, I am. I am too, but except I can't do it, and Max can do it. But there's a difference there.
Oh, yes, that's true. How well I know that. How is it that the two of us who don't write poetry love poetry?
I know. Well, maybe that's why.
So, what's on your mind?
What's on my mind is a new program that has already begun on PBS called The Great American Read. It began on May 22nd. The hostess is Meredith Fiera, and I'm not sure how long it's going on, but it is based on a list that PBS made up called the 100 Most Loved Novels in America. And the purpose of this program, which is going to include interviews with writers and readers and everybody for the next several weeks, is to pick the number one most beloved work of fiction in America.
They're copying our format.
They're copying our format, but I have the list of 100 books, and it is a very interesting list.
I take it it's not one either one of us would agree with 100%.
Well, it depends. These aren't the greatest novels. Let me test you. What's the best novel you've ever read, or what's a really great novel?
Lord of the Rings.
It's on here.
Okay, well.
Another one.
They passed the test.
Another one. Yes, Lord of the Rings is on here.
Oh, boy, now you got me stuck because I'm not a great novel reader. I can't name one.
Well, this list is interesting because some of the greats are here. Crime and Punishment by Dostoevsky is here.
I read that.
But also so is The Shack, which is that book about the boy whose daughter dies and goes to heaven, and Jesus comes in the form of a woman in a shack out in the woods and stuff. The Da Vinci Code, they've really, 50 Shades of Grey is here.
Oh, come on.
Okay, no. Alex Cross Mysteries, Alice's Adventures in Wonderland, and There Were None by Agatha. It is a really an interesting list. The Invisible Man is here. So they have, these are not necessarily great. Mm-hmm. To me, the greatest novel written in the 20th century is here, and that is 100 Years of Solitude by the Colombian writer Garcia Marquez. But The Adventures of Tom Sawyer is here, but not Huck Finn. Right. Huh. Crime and Punishment is here, but not The Brothers Kay. And I guess
that's wrong.
Yeah. These are popular.
They're going by popularity, huh?
No, best loved.
Best loved.
Yeah, that are really popular. And so Dune is here by George Herbert. Flowers in the Attic, Foundation, Frankenstein. The book that's here that I was not prepared to ever find on a list like this is Pilgrim's Progress.
Really?
Have you ever read Pilgrim's Progress?
No. Just by reputation, I would not touch it.
It is a great read.
Uh-huh.
It really is a great read. Its intention was not to be a great read. Its intention was to be a moral lesson about how its allegorical character, Christian, goes through this world and gets to the pearly gates. But it is so full of realistic, down-to-earth English countryside and English rough characters, the giant despair, you know, and the slough of despond and stuff, that you ought to read it. But I have no idea why it's here. You can tell some of the books are here are books that have become popular in teaching in high school. Lonesome Dove by McMurtry is here. Lord of the Rings, The Lovely Bones. Moby Dick is here. 1984 is here. The Outsiders, Picture of Dorian Gray. But Prayer for Owen Meany. And another book that I did not expect to be here, The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime.
I have read that.
That is a good book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I have no quarrel. I don't have any quarrel with any of these being here, but it is such an interesting, varied list.
You know, I am ostracized in literary circles because I've never read Jane Austen. My younger sister says she wonders why she even bothers to speak to me.
Well, Pride and Prejudice is here.
Yeah, well, it's got to be there.
There is no James Joyce. There is no Faulkner, no D.H. Lawrence, no Virginia Woolf, which I suppose is understandable. I mean, they're not the most beloved books.
Well, James Joyce, I don't think, he writes literary stunts rather than
Dubliners
books.
Would be there. Yeah. I mean, but not, The Book Thief is here, The Call of the Wild is here, Catch 22, Catcher in the Rye, simply because kid has used to read that.
That's true.
So I'm interested in how they arrived at this list because it really is, there is just enough black literature, enough feminist literature, enough of, I mean, they really, this is, the more you look at this list, the more carefully selected these things are. I'm curious as to which of these 100 books, and that's the choice that listeners are going to have. You have to send in on the internet your choice. Which of these is going to turn out to be the great? It turns out that I have read 43 of the 100.
Oh, well, you
and
are.
I have taught about 10 of the 43.
Okay, well, when you're tired of listening to this program, watch that on TV. But a warning that we're going to keep it up. I'm Don Wooten with Roll Tweet. Thank you for joining us today, and we'll hope to have you with us for the next edition of Scribble.